All right. Hello, and welcome back to Real Seekers. I'm your host, Dale, the Real Seeker. And today is a special show, or it was supposed to be. I was supposed to bring on Dr. David Kemble Cook, who, as you guys will know, he was a former Christian, or really a biblical Unitarian, which I don't consider to be a Christian. But after that, he's deconverted and he's left the faith. So, yeah, we've been doing a series, bringing him on, looking at his objections, why he doesn't believe, and that sort of thing. And I've been trying to provide a counter response to that. Last episode, we've been going over the philosophical issue of the prior probability of miracles. And David Kemble Cook's been giving me issues in terms of my use of Bayes' theorem, or the Bayes-ish formula. Yeah, basically, he sent me a list of his final issues, and I'm going to cover it. This is one last time, because I've done several shows now on Bayes' theorem and the math, and it's getting to be too much. So this is going to be my last show talking about the math. David Casey, I hope this answers your questions. And going forward, we'll move on strictly looking at the historical evidence for the resurrection and that sort of thing. But yeah, still no email or anything like that. So let me share my screen and go through the questions that David Casey sent me to respond to. And so I'm sharing my screen. All right, so full screen. All right, so as you can see, resurrection and the math one last time. My probabilistic arguments, essentially the summarization of the topics that we've covered in previous shows were the nature of that David Casey wants me to go over are the nature of the probabilities I'm using, my use of Bayes' theorem in general, the Jeffrey conditionalization formula, my Bayes-ish method, the principle of indifference, and resurrection without assuming God. David Casey asks, what are the nature of your probabilities that you're using? Are they subjective or objective? Well, according to David Casey, Dale typically says they are subjective, which is true, I guess. Not technically true, but yes, I call them subjective. And I've done so on other shows. Yet on occasions, he talks about the real numbers as if they are objective. So no, I don't say that they're fully objective. For example, I cite a value of 100% on the ontological argument in terms of proving God exists. And he says that this is a spurious accuracy of two decimal places, right? So I converted with 53.14%, and this invites ridicule. And he thinks it would be less misleading to give a range. Okay, so on David Casey's questions here, are Dale's probability values subjective or objective? Well, they're both, right? Because I call them subjective probabilities. They are, through introspection, I'm giving my own subjective credence levels, my degree of warrant that is unique to me and subjective. However, it's not a purely arbitrary or purely subjective thing. There is an objective component, because I say that my, based on the evidence and the reasons, the objective evidence and reasons, my subjective credence levels are based on that objective standard of what a reasonable real seeker would assign as they could assign as a valid level of warrant for that set of evidence. So it's a semi-objective standard. It's the same standard that is used in the law courts, the reasonable person's test, which is a semi-objective standard. And on this basis, some people are reasonable, some people are unreasonable. So for example, on the Holocaust, the evidence is quite strong. We've got all various uncontroversial lines of evidence. So if I assign my own subjective warrant level as 99%, and David Casey assigns it 99.9%. Okay, those are both within the reasonableness range, right? I could say, yes, a reasonable person or a reasonable real seeker could assign each of those levels. However, if somebody also looks at the same evidence, privy to this exact same evidence that we are and all that, there are epistemic equals on that front, but they assigned a 20% degree of warrant, that is outside of the reasonableness range. That person is not a reasonable person and or a reasonable real seeker in that case. And their subjective probability values can be dismissed as such. So that's why I say it's a semi-objective standard, right? But ultimately, the value I'm giving is my own subjective warrant level for me, right? I'm not trying to assign, well, what is the reasonableness range? What is the range of all the subjective levels of warrant or credence that qualify as being reasonable? I don't know nor care about that. No one. I just care that about proving that the value I give does fit in that reasonableness range. So, I hope that helps. Now, by reasonableness, I refer to the civil law definition of an average person with average intelligence, average knowledge set, average discernment and wisdom, the average person. And court systems use this all the time without an issue. So any and all probability values assigned by a reasonable real seeker on issues pertaining to the truth or falsity of a religion is a value that is warranted, defined by Alvin Plantinga, or at least warranted-ish. And on previous shows, I've gotten into the difference between warrant and warranted-ish. So there's a debate in epistemology called the permissivism versus uniqueness thesis. So remember, I said there's a reasonableness range, right? So when evaluating religions, maybe I'm 99% and David Casey is 99.7% or something like that in terms of our subjective degrees of warrant, but both are fit within this reasonableness range. So that would be a position in epistemology known as permissivism, right? Having different values is permitted, and yet we're all still rational on a given set of evidence. Now, of course, again, depending on the strength of that evidence, there are sometimes people that are outside of that range. They're unreasonable, and those subjective warrant values are not permitted. But under permissivism, they do permit different subjects or different individuals to assign differing levels of warrant to a given proposition or hypothesis on the evidence, and that's permitted. You're still rational. You're still a rational or reasonable person. Versus the uniqueness thesis, which says, look, in order to be warranted, there's only one value. Look, based on this evidence, if you have the same set of evidence and you're all equal, epistemic equals and that sort of thing, no, it's 99%. That's what you've got to do. If you assign 99.1, you're not warranted. You're unreasonable. You're outside the range. It's only one value is the correct value. Now, on this debate, I have a unique take, right? So I am technically a uniqueness thesis person. In terms of warrant proper, the Alvin Plantinga definition, I think that only the subjective credence level that God would assign for a hypothesis on a set of data, that's the only warranted subjective credence level. We ought, as image bearers of God, we all ought to have the exact same thing as God does, right? That is the true warranted credence. So hypothetically, if God were not omniscient and he was only privy to the evidence and evidential factors that Dale is, maybe he would assign 99% to the Holocaust or he would assign 55% to the resurrection of Jesus or something like that, just for the sake of argument, to keep it simple. 55% for the resurrection is the correct value. That is the only value that is warranted in terms of your level of credence. No other values would be permitted. However, here's my unique take, is that I also allow for permissivism because of the effects of sin. And this is what I call being warranted-ish, or this reasonableness range, where God restrains the effects of sin for all reasonable real seekers to keep them within a reasonableness range where they are warranted-ish, right? So even if God assigns 55% for the resurrection, and I'm 53.4% or something like that, or I'm 54%, okay, I'm not exactly as God, but I am still warranted-ish. I'm within what I'm calling this reasonableness range, and it's good enough to know that something is true, you know, that the resurrection happened or something like that. So that's just a side debate or a technicality based on a debate in the epistemology, in philosophy, in epistemology there. But I hope that explains to you, David Casey, where I'm coming from. Okay, so David Casey also objects, citing a value of PG of 100% on the basis of the ontological argument and inviting readers to accept it as a real number. So by real number, remember what I'm talking about now. It's based on, it's a number that a reasonable real seeker could assign as their own subjective level of credence based on the evidence, is to invite ridicule. Okay, so I just say, says who, David Casey? Who are you're not the arbiter of truth. Who are you to ridicule me? I say, no, it does work. What proof does David Casey bring to the table to back up his ridiculous and unsubstantiated claim that a reasonable real seeker could not be rational or warranted in knowing that God exists in the 100% degree on the basis of the ontological argument? You know, it's one, you can't just give a mindless objection or any or something like that and expect that to hold water. I can just assert, no, they could. Great, assertions are easy, right? So, basically, David Casey gives us no reason to think that it's not, that the 100% level for the ontological argument for the existence of God is not within the reasonableness range that a reasonable real seeker could assign. And I just give the example because, interestingly, David Casey mentions that he is a skeptic of the moon landings. So this is a radical position on his end, right? And some skeptics like David Johnson and stuff have said, look, well, we could just dismiss it. Like they were shocked, like, oh my, this is a ridiculous position. How could anyone be a skeptic of the moon landings? That's, you're a conspiracy theorist and a flat earther. Just get out of here. Well, no, I don't do that. I don't treat people. I've had a flat earther on my show. I don't treat skepticism about the moon landing in the same way. No, I just, cool, this is your opinion. Give me the evidence and I will assess it as a reasonable real seeker and see if your level of credence is within the reasonableness range or not. I don't just automatically say, you know, well, you think, you know, your hypothesis is that the moon landings were a hoax. I don't like that personally. It sounds ridiculous. It's not consistent with my assessment of the evidence, which I have to admit has not been that in depth on that specific question. Therefore, I'm just going to dismiss you. No, let's sit down, get into it. Why do you believe this? Give me your evidence and I will assess that on my own. That's the way we should be. David Casey says that there's a spurious accuracy of two decimal places and this invites ridicule. So first of all, I do assign ranges in certain cases where I myself as the reasonable real seeker have a subjective range. There are sometimes where the evidence is not precise enough that I'm like, yeah, I'm 53% or I'm 78% on this. Sometimes I'm kind of, okay, well, I'm between 60 to 65 or 65 to 75% based on this evidential factor that I'm assessing. And in that case, I do assign ranges. And what I do for the purposes of Bayes is I would plug in the number that hurt the case for Christianity the most. If it was a positive factor, I would take the lowest number. If it was something that hurt the case against Christianity as a negative evidence, I would take the highest number within that range. And that's what I would plug into Bayes' theorem to be biased against my hypothesis. And hang on one second. I just want to check. Did David Casey show up? No. Okay. Okay. So I'm going to continue on then. I don't think he's coming. David Casey provides nothing but a biased dismissal here. And maybe if I admit that's just in his slides sending me questions, maybe if he was here in person, he'd provide more reason as to why he's giving this. But look, if you're just going to give an assertion that my putting it to two decimal places is ridiculous, then I'm just going to dismiss that it's ridiculous because it makes sense to me. Now, I did get a more substantive objection on this front from another PhD mathematician who's a skeptic. He's always been against me on Bayes' theorem, though more recently he has been more supportive of me, but not fully supportive of my use of Bayes' theorem. But he mentions this thing, look, of significant figures. And this is a rule in math, right? So usually my in what the rule of significant figures is that your final number, right? Remember, for Christianity, when I converted, I got 53.14%. So those are four significant figures, right? I've got two decimal places afterwards. But all of my inputs don't really have four significant figures. I usually plug in like 65% or 73% or something like that. It's only two significant figures. So technically, I'm violating this mathematical rule. It's a technicality, and I'm violating this. And Anthony 66, and I presume David Casey would say, well, this is misleading. You're giving a false sense of precision by giving these decimals. Look, I respect that this is a mathematical rule that I'm violating, but I know the purpose for the rule, and I don't think that the criticism applies. I'm not being misleading. And in fact, I'm being more accurate than had I done anything else, right? Because look, I plugged in the numbers here. Here are the inputs, 60%, 75%, 52% for, you know, evidences one, two, and three. These are just for the sake of argument. I plug that into my Bayes' theorem formula, and out pops, this is the number I get when I just plug in these numbers in the calculator, 82.97872340425532%, right? That's just what the calculator gives me. I'm not doing anything. I'm not rounding. I'm not doing anything with it. This is the number that you get literally from plugging in these numbers. Well, I arbitrarily decided to round to have four significant figures, right? To have the 82.98% thing. I just arbitrarily chose that because I like the two decimal places and that sort of thing. Now, that is more accurate to the actual result than saying, oh, well, it's got to be 82% because you only plugged in, you know, two significant figures. 60% is 60, 75 is 75. 52 is 52. So it should technically be 82%. That's what you should have said it is. Because otherwise you're just misleading. Well, I don't think so. I think that putting it with the two decimal places is fine. So long as I'm being upfront that, hey, look what I'm doing is these inputs are based on my semi-objective, reasonable reasonable real seeker, what they could assign as a subjective level of warrant for each of the individual factors. I'm not pretending this is a statistical mathematical calculation or something like that. So as long as I clarify what I'm doing with these numbers and what they are and what they aren't, then I think that avoids the need to follow this rule. But even if you want to say, okay, Dale, you messed up, you should follow this rule, then okay, actually it would be 83% then, right? So it would round up. 82.98% would round up to 83, not 82. So great, you're making my numbers even higher in favor of Christianity, skeptic. Thank you for helping the case for Christianity then. So yeah, that's my take on that. Okay, so David Casey's next objection on Bayes' theorem, Dale multiplies probabilities of individual events to get the probability of the evidence given R. However, this can only be done under the assumption of independence. And Dale does not mention that. So in the first place, I would just say, who cares, right? So he's talking about in the context of a specific show that I did called Calculus for Christ with the atheist David Johnson. So that's what he's specifically referring to here, and I didn't mention that the probabilities are independent, but they are, right? So when I give the probabilities for the resurrection, right? So I have the various evidential pieces here, 100%, 70%, 5%, 90%. I am assuming these independently prove the truth of the hypothesis when I'm plugging them into the formula, right? So there's not a dependence factor, which would mean that they're not, they shouldn't increase the probability as though I have two separate independent lines of evidence, right? So for example, the empty tomb and the appearance to Paul, these are clearly independent evidences, right? The empty tomb really had nothing to do or isn't really relevant to the appearance, to explaining the appearance to Paul. That's relatively independent. Whereas the empty tomb might be argued to say, well, the empty tomb and the appearance to the individual appearance to Peter or something. Well, in that case, you could argue, well, they're not two separate evidences because one, you know, the empty tomb helped to cause Peter to be in a state of grief, and then that caused him to have a grief hallucination. So that's where you would get into questions of dependence versus independent evidences. And I do that when I assess the resurrection. In the first place, it doesn't matter anyways, because I only had one line of evidence that worked, the appearance to the 12. So I didn't really need to mention dependence or independence because I've only got one line of evidence that I felt proved that the resurrection was probably true. But the point is, when I'm assessing the, if I were assessing the cumulative case, I would definitely assess the independent, are these independent sources of warrant to prove that the hypothesis is true, or are they dependent? I don't know what he wants to say about that. Obviously I was just keeping it simple to illustrate how the math worked in general on that show. So David Casey says, the appearance to Paul is included as evidence, but this is irrelevant to the bodily resurrection. The individual probabilities assume that the gospel narratives are correct. However, why not then just include the resurrection in the evidence and get 100%? So this is the first place. Look, the appearance to Paul is relevant to the bodily resurrection. You can't just assert and assume as a skeptic that, oh no, Paul just had a vision. Well, that's under dispute, right? I've researched the evidence. I can prove he had a bodily resurrection appearance. So you can't just beg the question as though I'm just unaware of it when I'm in giving a Calculus for Christ show. Which was a math lesson. It wasn't about debating the evidence. Obviously, if I have someone who wants to debate the evidence, well, was Paul's appearance of Jesus, was that a bodily resurrection appearance, or was it just some vision like some skeptics try to claim Acts of the Apostles suggests? Great, we can get into that, and I can prove that you're wrong, David Casey. But that has no bearing on what I was doing in the show, Calculus for Christ, where I was just trying to quickly illustrate how the math would work if I could assume that the appearance to Paul was a relevant evidential factor for proving the resurrection. Now, the individual probabilities assume that the gospel narratives are correct. Again, not for me. No, I do painstaking work to prove that the elements of the gospel narratives that I use as evidence for the resurrection have been proven true on a balance of probabilities. So this is why, for example, in my case for the resurrection, I would not use, oh, well, there was a guard at the tomb, because I don't argue we can prove that probably happened outside of making a general reliability argument for the Gospels in general or something like that. I don't just assume that, for example, one of the arguments for the appearances to the 12 or groups is that the hallucinations would have to be multimodal because they touched him, they could smell him, they could hear him, they could see him. So it would have had to have been a multimodal hallucination if those gospel narratives are just fully correct in everything they assert, where Jesus sat down, he ate with them and stuff. In my case for the resurrection, I'm far more skeptical. I don't claim to just assert that, well, the gospel says it, therefore it's true. No, I construct historical proof and argumentation from the gospel narratives to establish the specific elements of those stories that I think I can prove are true historically, as a secular historian, just like Bart Ehrman or anyone else, you know, Dale Allison, they will all agree with those elements, even if they disagree with other elements of the story. So this is just not true. Again, taking me out of context in a show on the calculus for Christ, where I'm just trying to illustrate how math works and not have a debate on the historical evidence proper, just don't think that's kind of a fair thing to do. And finally, I could just say the same thing to you, right? You're just asserting that the gospel narratives are not correct, and you're just asserting that Paul is irrelevant. Nothing you sent me proves that that's true. You just assert it. So I can just dismiss you then. Okay, the Jeffrey conditionalization formula. So he's taking the slides that I did where I actually put in the calculation, because he challenged me to put in actual numbers, right? And I said, okay, well, I'm just trying to take a shortcut and say it's 50%. I can't prove that God is motivated to raise Jesus from the dead, and we can't prove that he's not motivated. So let's just look at the evidence straightforwardly. And that's our default prior probability. Okay, so David Casey wanted me to plug in some actual numbers, and I said, well, it'll be more than 50% then. And look what I got, 50.49% as a worst case scenario. Okay, so what are objections to that? Purpose is to evaluate. Okay, so the purpose is to estimate a value for the prior probability using probabilities for an uncertain event. In this case, the existence of a God who would have motivation to raise Jesus, right? So it's uncertain. Is God motivated or not? And if you have zero evidence one way or the other, or zero persuasive evidences, because there have been evidential arguments given on both sides, right? For example, Richard Swinburne tries to argue that, no, based on the prior probability, it is more probable than not that God would be motivated to raise Jesus from the dead. And skeptics on the other side have tried to say, no, it's improbable God would be motivated to raise Jesus from the dead. Now, my thing is I've looked into those, and I've just, for my purposes, when I studied the resurrection and the miracle, I said, I don't think that these things are persuasive on a balance of probabilities. They are unsuccessful evidential factors. And for that reason, I remain at the point of indifference, the 50% prior probability. And that is the default to give there. And it's on the basis, he also asked me, on what basis is 50% the prior probability if you have zero evidence one way or the other? And it philosophers, it's what's called the principle of indifference, right? So if you've got two or more hypotheses or something like that, the prior probability and no evidence speaking in favor of one or more of those hypotheses against the rest, well, then the prior probability that any specified hypothesis is just randomly correct is going to be, it's either at 50%, right? It's either true or it's not. And it's the same for each of those hypotheses, those other hypotheses. So that's the principle of indifference, okay? So my Bayes-ish approach, he's going to go after me. So here's the Bayes formula proper, right? So it's based on a conditional probability. What's the probability that we would have this evidence given we assume the resurrection is true? We would have the evidence of the empty tomb or the appearance to the women given we assume the resurrection is true. Now, my Bayes-ish approach, I characterize it as though I'm giving the probability, just a direct probability, like what we have the appearance to the women. Does that fact prove that the resurrection is probably true? Well, to what degree? Maybe all 60%, maybe six, whatever my degree of warrant is after considering all of the evidential factors relevant to that bit of evidence, the appearance to the women. So I was kind of saying like, it's just 60%. Now, the criticisms I've gotten from Anthony 6-6 and from David Casey is that, okay, well, this isn't the proper way to state what you're doing, because I'm not, it's not like, look, the probability of R given E and B would just be like, I'm reinserting this formula as this factor. And quite obviously, that's not what I'm doing. I'm not having formulas within formulas. I'm just trying to say, look, this factor is just, look, what's the probability I can prove that there was this empty tomb or appearance to the 12 or whatever the specific evidence is, and to what degree is that significant in terms of proving the hypothesis is true? And that's all that I'm plugging in here for each separate bit of evidence that independently proves the hypothesis is true. And then obviously you factor in your prior probability as well. So that's all I'm doing here. I'm using this formula simply to get, look, I've got five or six independent evidential considerations that I think prove the hypothesis is true on a balance of probabilities. And I've got my prior probability factor here. I plug them into this formula to find out, okay, overall, where do I sit? What is the cumulative total of all of those evidential factors? That's all I use this formula for, nice and simple. And you can see here's a perfect example that I gave. And look, you've got each independent thing, right? 70% evidential factor, and then 80%. You plug that in and you get total of 92% that the hypothesis is true, given those three evidential factors, plus your prior probability based on the background evidence, which I said is neutral. It's at the 50%. So if those numbers are correct, you would end up with a total of 92% that the resurrection is true. It's just a simple way of getting the cumulative total. That's all I'm using the formula for. And I've had this confirmed by at least 4 to 5 mathematical experts, including Anthony 66, that for the purpose that I'm using it, it works. I get the correct mathematical result in terms of the cumulative total given these inputs. So that's all I care about. If you're trying to say, well, look, you put in this symbol and this is wrong. This is a conditional probability, which means you're putting in this formula into this factor. Okay, well, that's not what I'm doing, and that's not what I meant to convey. So fine, if this is the wrong set of symbols to represent what I'm doing, great. Tell me what symbols to plug in here as a mathematician. I'll plug that in. But the point is, the maths work in terms of how I'm using the evidence and the formula that I'm using to get the cumulative total. That's all I care about. You know, if I need to use different symbols to represent that, fine. So he's saying, how is the formula derived, the Bayes-ish formula derived? Just derived from basic common sense, math, and my own head, as well as being confirmed by several PhD mathematicians at secular universities. These are not, also Tim McGrew, but outside of Tim McGrew, these were secular PhD mathematicians teaching at secular universities. They didn't care about religion. They didn't care about the resurrection. I just simply asked them, look, here's what I'm doing, and here's how I'm using this Bayes formula. Is it achieving the result that I wanted in terms of the cumulative total? They all said, yes, it works. It's doing what you're doing. And even I have a quote here from Anthony 66. Again, he is one that has usually been skeptical of what I'm doing. And again, based on, you know, the symbology of what I'm putting in, same with David Casey, he doesn't like that I'm putting in, well, look, you're not giving the probability of the hypothesis given the evidence. That's the wrong symbol because you're not using a conditional probability. Okay, cool. Tell me what symbol to put in here. You know, I've told you what I'm doing with the numbers. Just tell me what symbol you want me to use, and I'll use that. So that explains the direct. Okay, so Dale assumes that the probability of God, given the ontological and cosmological argument, are multiplied together, right? So these are two independent arguments for the hypothesis that God exists. The ontological argument is independent of the cosmological argument. And David Casey is saying, well, look, you shouldn't be multiplying in true probability theory, assuming, okay, so again, he's into the symbols, assuming that it's a conditional, I shouldn't be multiplying. Okay, I don't care. Maybe I used the wrong symbol. The point is, I've got two independent bits of evidences that I've assigned my own, as a reasonable real seeker, I've assigned my own subjective credence level of warrant to those factors in terms of directly proving the hypothesis God exists is true. And now I want to know what the cumulative total is. Following the formula, you multiply it, right? I guess arguments are not events. Okay, well, if you want to call it an event that I'm assigning a subjective credence level to this, fine. That's what I'm doing, right? In terms of this. So yeah, basically, maybe I mathematically screwed up in the symbols that I used. I assumed the conditional was the appropriate symbol to use because it makes sense, right? That what is the probability that the hypothesis God exists is true, given I have the ontological argument and I have the cosmological argument? Those are the two evidences, and my subjective level of warrant assigned to each of those arguments in terms of proving the hypothesis. To my mind, the conditional statement or symbol represents that properly. So if it doesn't, you know, you explain to me as a mathematician what it's supposed to be. Let me just double check. I don't even know if this is Vulture here. Okay, so the word perfect occurs. Okay, so yep. So Vulture's giving some more math patterns and stuff, but God gives understanding. What does the unbeliever understand? Vulture, I think that the unbeliever does have understanding. They're not totally spiritually dead in terms of the Calvinist sense. Like, obviously, they do understand certain mathematical truths, like 1 + 1 = 2, or they can have secular knowledge and stuff. But I agree with you that, you know, if you're not a reasonable real seeker and you're not receptive to the enablement of the Holy Spirit in terms of spiritual truths and theological truths, you can understand nothing. You're in a state of rebellion against God and stuff like that. So you're going to reject the gospel message ultimately on that front. So, yep. All right. David Casey then says, if Anthony is right in saying that the Bayes-ish method turns out to be Bayes, okay, so we found out it isn't. So I'm not doing this, right? So he asks, which would be more correct, the Bayes or the Bayes-ish method? Look, Bayes' theorem has been proven in probability calculus. And every PhD mathematician I spoke to when I was talking about my method, including Dr. Tim McGrew, just said, look, what you're doing just ain't Bayes. So Bayes is superior and has been mathematically proven and stuff that it's valid and that it works. But with the Bayes-ish method, that also works for the purpose that I'm using it in terms of just an easy way to take a bunch of independent events or evidences that prove a hypothesis is true and getting the cumulative total. The math doesn't lie on that front. I absolutely achieve that event. Now that said, David Casey asks me later on, why did you opt for the Bayes-ish method rather than just using what's already been established with Bayes' theorem? And the simple truth is, years ago when I was trying to put together, you know, figure out a way to put all of the different pieces of evidence together to make up an overall total judgment on some of these things, like the evidences for the resurrection, the simple truth was I didn't understand Bayes' theorem. I didn't get the usefulness of conditional probabilities or how that helped. I mean, for example, I remember saying, look, if we assume the resurrection is true, then of course it's 100% proven. We would have an empty tomb. It's 100% we would have these appearances. So it's just going to be 100% in favor of the resurrection hypothesis, right? And I didn't understand about how we also factor in the alternative non-resurrection hypotheses and put that together and stuff like that. So the simple truth was, over 10 years ago or whenever it was, I just didn't understand Bayes' theorem. So I opted to use the numbers that made sense to me, but utilize the formula in a way that would still get me the result I was looking for in terms of the cumulative total. And on that front, it's sufficient. And I think this is more commonsensical and easier for non-mathematicians who, can you expect laymen in every century just to understand conditional probabilities and to get into these fractions of a thing like, oh, there's a 1 in 10 to the power of 50 chance that this will happen. And I don't think we need to get into that. I think my way is much more straightforward. Look, you consider the evidence for the empty tomb, and what is the empty tomb? If true, what is the significance for proving that the resurrection hypothesis is true? And you assign your direct level of credence to that, 60%, 65%, much more. And then all you're doing with the math is just, you do that for each of the separate pieces of evidence in terms of their proving the same hypothesis true. You plug that into the formula and out pops up your final number. That's much more intuitive, much more commonsensical, much more easier to understand than doing a proper Bayesian analysis. So that's what I would say to you, David Casey. So as long as what I'm doing is mathematically sound for the purpose that I'm using the formula, you can't just complain, even if, I get that, Bayes' theorem is more well-established and has been proven in probability calculus by experts for centuries now since it was invented and stuff. And I get that people with a professional mathematical background prefer Bayes to my Bayes-ish method. They think that's the proper way to go and stuff like that. I just don't, even if it's a better way, I don't think that the Bayes-ish way is wrong. It is mathematically valid for the purpose that I'm using it. So the principle of indifference. So what is it used for? So he's talking about in terms of assessing the prior probability with the conditional, the Jeffrey conditionalization formula. So essentially I use the principle of indifference for the probability that God would be for M based on the background knowledge. So what is M? It just represents God would be motivated. So let me try to go back to that. Oh, is it not? Yeah. Okay, perfect. So basically this should have GM here, right? The God exists and is motivated, right? So that the principle of indifference is what I employ for M, because on the background knowledge, we have great arguments proving that God exists. And I said in the 100 percentile mark, based on the ontological argument, cosmological argument, stuff like that. But then there's that other question of, and what is the probability that God is motivated? Even if he exists, what's the prior probability that he would be motivated to raise Jesus from the dead or not? And on that front, I don't think we have any successful evidences proving one way or the other as to God's motivations. It's just inscrutable to us. And because of that, that's where I assigned that 50 percentile mark. And where does the 50 percentile mark? Well, that come from? Well, that's where I was telling you guys about the principle of indifference in philosophy, right? Where you are indifferent, you give an equal probability to the hypothesis being, to a given hypothesis being true or to a given hypothesis being false, if the background evidence doesn't speak one way or another. Okay, so that's where it comes from. Yeah, the principle of indifference is specifically related to whether or not God has a motivation to raise Jesus from the dead or not. That's where I'm getting that from. So David Casey says, it is not a principle that has universal assent. Fair enough. again, maybe there are people out there who question it, but I don't care. There are people out there who question the moon landing, such as yourself. There are people out there that question that 1 + 1 = 2, right? In philosophy, we have something called fuzzy logic. I don't care. These people are wrong. I'm right. They're wrong. And the vast, vast, virtually all PhD philosophers and scholars accept fundamental principles like the principle of indifference here. So I believe I'm warranted in accepting this. I don't care. You're always going to find some whack job out there who disagrees with the most basic common sense truths and stuff. We live in a sinful, fallen world where people's cognitive faculties have been corrupted. And unfortunately, that leads to people denying something as obvious and self-evident as 1 + 1 = 2. And apparently, there are some people out there who deny the principle of indifference. Great. I'm right. They're wrong. Don't care. I've got warrant for believing in it. They don't have warrant for their disbelief. It uses subjective probabilities. Well, we covered that already. It's not purely subjective in the sense that it's arbitrary, but it is my subjective individual level of credence or warrant as a reasonable real seeker, given the assessment of the objective evidences and objective reasons in favor of that level of warrant based on the evidence. So yeah, it's a semi-objective standard, and I've already kind of covered that. Now, one thing I would say, okay, well, if you're not giving a purely objective probability here, you might say, well, why should you trust even if it's semi-objective or semi-subjective in any way, if there's any element of subjectivity, and you admit that, you know, in a sinful world, our cognitive faculties do err and stuff, why should we trust in them? And that's where I get into my argument, whereby if you are a reasonable real seeker, then God has to prevent undue confusion. As a real maximally great being, he wants us to know religious truths that are key for our salvation, right? Us achieving our ultimate purpose in creation. And therefore God, since he's omnipotent and omniscient and omnibenevolent, will guarantee that any and all reasonable real seekers assigning their own semi-objective credence levels or warrant levels to the given evidence after doing their best to see it will come in the end to truth and will fall within that reasonableness range. And they will also be prevented from falling into error in such a way that it would cause undue confusion. And I define undue confusion as being unjustifiably confused through no fault of our own in such a way that we would not achieve our ultimate purpose in creation. Well, you know, God, I believe God is obligated to ultimately save and therefore bring a saving knowledge of the gospel message to any and all reasonable real seekers before the point of no return. I believe that point is at the point of death. Other scholars have said maybe you can still get saved even after death. I think the biblical view is that it's the point of death. So yeah, any and all reasonable real seekers will come to a saving knowledge of Christ before they die. And otherwise, that would mean God is allowing undue confusion. So it's basically the role of God ensuring that I won't be unduly confused, that allows me to rest secure in the probability values that I'm assigning as a reasonable real seeker, despite the fact that there is an element of subjectivity in the probability values that I'm using. So I hope that makes sense. Okay, so resurrection without assuming God responds. David Casey says, we might in theory have enough evidence for a modern day resurrection, but not for one 2,000 years ago. At a distance of 2,000 years, with a gap of at least 20 years between events and recording, all we have is a probable belief that the disciples believed in the resurrection. A mistaken belief of, say, Peter or Mary Magdalene that they had seen Jesus could have grown into the stories in the Gospels, and many details accrued in the retelling or supplied by the authors. Okay, so in the first place, the critical objection, I just say, who says we can't? I disagree with you. You're just going to assert that we can't have enough evidence from 2,000 years ago, I might as well just assert, no, we can and we do have enough to confirm the resurrection, even though it happened 2,000 years ago. Look at the date of the evidence. We can't have a chronological snobbery about this. The date of the evidence doesn't matter. It's the quality of the evidence. And look, the historical sources, they don't date 2,000 years after the fact. They're within 20 years or even sooner, within a few years in the case of the creeds and hymns that we can prove date back to the original disciples in Jerusalem. These are right after the event itself from eyewitness testimony. It's about proving the quality, and that is what we base the sufficiency on. We don't look back and say, oh, well, it's 2,000 years from now. Like, think how stupid that is. Like, think of the evidence for something that's undeniable to you historically, like the Holocaust, right? So look, in the year 1950, the evidence, or let's say 1980, when all of the evidence was coming in and was known about fully by all the people, you would say you're like 99.99% warranted in believing the Holocaust is a real event. Now, let's say we maintain that same evidence, the same degree of evidence, but we go forward 2,000 years into the future, just because of the fact that, oh, but that evidence is now 2,000 years old. That changes nothing. That does not matter. It's all about the quality of the evidence, and that quality remains the same, regardless of how much time has eclipsed since the event itself has taken place. So I just wanted to make that basic statement that, look, it doesn't matter how long ago an event was. All that matters is what is the quality of the evidence that we have sufficient to say, yeah, this event probably happened or not. And on that front, historians are able to say historical events from 2,000 years ago or even further back in time happened all the time. And you would be unreasonable and foolish to deny those historical events. So the gap of at least 20 years between events and recording, all we have is a probable belief. Great, probable belief is sufficient, right? If it's under, as an evidentialist, you follow the evidence and apportion your belief accordingly. If the evidence proves that the resurrection probably happened, then you believe, kind of thing, right? And in terms of this gap of 20 years, no, we've got oral creeds. We can prove that we have material going back to the eyewitnesses within, you know, Gert Ludemann says 6 months after the resurrection. You can't just deny this out of your bias and just assert that such things are not evidence. We need to sit down and debate this stuff. A probable belief that the disciples believed in the resurrection. So, yep, Gary Habermas does qualify and says that the disciples, what the minimal fact is that the disciples believed in the resurrection, rather than saying that the disciples actually saw the resurrected Christ. And he just does that to appease the skeptics and says that basically the historical data point that we need to prove is that, well, based on the sources, we can prove the disciples at least believed in the resurrection, rather than arguing for the stronger position that, well, the disciples actually saw Jesus. No, Gary Habermas takes care of proving that at the explanatory level, not at the fact level, because there are three levels that we need to assess when assessing the historical evidence for the resurrection. Number one, what are our historical sources of information and the reliability of them and the author and that sort of thing? Then this is the historical factual question. What facts can we prove or glean from those sources? And then finally, we have the explanatory level where we look at explanatory hypotheses and how they perform to see which is the best explanation in terms of explaining that historical data. So I think that myself and Gary Habermas and stuff, we at the factual level, we just argue that we can prove the disciples at least believed they had a resurrection appearance. We don't have to prove that they actually had an appearance until we get to the explanatory level. And that's where we go, well, guess what? We can prove the disciples at least believed they had a resurrection appearance. And in point of fact, through evaluating all of the explanatory hypotheses, we can prove that they did, in fact, probably have a resurrection appearance. Again, this, it's the point of the debate, right? And what you're giving me here, you're just asserting your opinions. And I don't care about that. I've made my own opinions based on studying the evidence. So let's, as we go through these shows, let's sit down and debate it, kind of thing, right? Okay, so yeah, that's my take on that. Oh goodness, when is this? Okay, good. Last slide on this thing. So resurrection without assuming God's response. We might, David Casey says, we might in theory have enough evidence for a modern day. Okay, so isn't this the same thing? This is, yeah, this is what he already said. All right. Okay, so let me just double check the thing in the chat. Any questions? Nope. Okay, so Vulture's giving his. Okay, so now I'm going to start moving into the evidence. And I'm just going to give two bits of factual data that for the truth of the empty tomb based on the archaeological evidence. So let me just get into that, right? So, okay, so establishing the historical facts for Jesus' resurrection. So in the first place, we have from the sources that David Casey accepts, we have Jesus died by crucifixion. David Casey has told me that he accepts this as a fact already. So I'm not going to bother arguing for it. But Dr. Gary Habermas has dozens of arguments for the death by crucifixion in his book, new book on the resurrection. So make sure to get that. But let's focus in on the next fact, the burial and empty tomb of Jesus. David Casey does not accept this fact, and instead he thinks that Jesus may have been thrown to a common pit or grave. So I'm going to try to establish this. My first way of doing that, so obviously Dr. Gary Habermas has just finished and published volume one of his massive four-volume book on the resurrection of Jesus. And Gary actually presents a total of 13 evidences proving the burial narrative of the Gospels and 21 arguments. And this should actually be 22 because I'm going to add one of my own here. Arguments supporting the empty tomb of Jesus. Now, I'm going to go over some of the most impressive arguments on that front with David Casey in a future show. But for today's show, I wanted to go over a bit of a surprise. I was planning it to be a surprise for David Casey, but I want to go over two arguments. And these arguments are based on archaeology. So it's not based on the historical sources. It's based on the archaeological sources of evidence. So the first is from the Nazareth Decree inscription. So this was an inscription that was found in Nazareth, and it's an imperial edict, or rather a rescript of an imperial edict, right? So when it went out to the provinces, a scribe would rewrite it and send it out to the place in Nazareth or whoever it was meant for, right? But it reflects an imperial edict from either Tiberius or more probably Claudius's reign, with a strong warning about meddling with tombs and graves. And it prescribes a punishment. If you break a seal or break into a tomb and steal bodies, your punishment would be death. And the claim is here that this obviously kind of supports the Gospels that Jesus had an empty tomb, because what was it the Jews responded with? Oh, well, the disciples stole the body. They were grave robbers. And so, okay, so that's, this is seen as providing archaeological support for the truth of this gospel claim that Jesus' tomb was found empty and it was falsely ascribed to body theft and grave robbers, namely through the disciples. And okay, so the Caesar is making this imperial edict. You better stop that. You steal bodies, you're dead. You get into grave robbing, you're dead. So that's the traditional claim from the Nazareth inscription. And you can see what it says here in terms of the text and talking about, you know, you're don't go after people who have been buried, or don't move buried bodies with wicked intent, those who have been buried to other places. And if you do so, you are committing a crime. Or if you move sepulcher sealing stones, just like Jesus in the Gospels, against such a person, I order that a judicial tribunal be created, just as concerning the gods in human religious observances. Okay, so That's what the text says. This is the majority translation. Now, in terms of the traditional dating, most historians date this imperial edict as a rump version to the late Emperor Tiberius, or else the early reign of the Emperor Claudius in the early 40s AD. And an interesting thing here is why do they usually associate this with Claudius in around 41, 42 AD? Well, number one, it uses the Greek word diatagma for edict. And this is a word that is extremely rare in ancient Greek texts, as well as in other imperial edicts from the emperors over the centuries. In fact, there are only about 8 such known examples of this word ever being used. Interestingly, 2 of these rare uses are from, guess who? The Emperor Claudius. Huge hint. And a third instance is even more intriguingly found in the New Testament, suggesting that link. Now, there are a handful of other Claudius-unique phraseologies within this inscription, again, attributing it to the Emperor Claudius here. And there's a total of about 70 out of 90 of the words in this all match Claudius versus other emperors. So linguistically here, there is a strong, very strong link to the Emperor Claudius as the one who made this imperial edict. And he came to power in 41 AD after Caligula. There's also evidence from the Sitz im Leben, the life situation which fits Claudius. So look, Jews in the 40s were on the verge of a revolt, right? Because they just had the crazy nutball of an emperor, Caligula, trying to put a statue in the temple, an abomination of desolation into the temple. And this riled up the Jews and got them, you know, against the Roman Empire throughout, even throughout the diaspora, not just in the Holy Land. And also King Herod Agrippa was also being a little bit of a bugger as he ruled the land. And he caused a lot of tumult in the early 40s, specifically in 42 AD, when he killed one of the apostles, James, the son of Zebedee, the brother of John, one of the pillars of the church. And this riled up the Jews to no end in the Holy Land. And obviously all of these problems were weighing heavily on Claudius when he took over as the emperor and stuff like that, and was being confronted with these problematic Jews creating such tumult over not only rebelling against the Christian teachings, which is what happened in Rome, right? The Jews, as Suetonius tells us, the Jews were getting riled up because they didn't like Christians talking about Christ or Christus, which means Jesus Christ, and his resurrection. And this was riling up the Jews who were rebelling against this Christian teaching in Rome. And that's where Claudius said, I'm fed up with all you Jews creating headaches. Just get out of the city. Get out of Rome. You're no longer welcome here. I'm sick and tired of you people creating these problems. I'm hearing about the resurrection of the body and stuff. Obviously, we know you stole Jesus' body and that sort of thing. I'm going to make a decree to stop this. Anyone who dares steal a body from a tomb, instant death, right? So the Sitz im Leben fits perfectly with Claudius's situation and what was going on to rile up the Jews during the reign of Claudius, which did not apply earlier in the 30s AD or any time before that, or even I would say after that until the late 60s, which we know it doesn't date from. We can prove that it doesn't date beyond the 40s AD type deal, right? But the only situation that fits this in terms of rebellious Jews and why the emperor would care what a bunch of Jews are, you know, about a body being stolen in a Jewish tomb and stuff like that. It all seems to fit. And it also illuminates that quote from Suetonius talking about, well, why did Claudius choose to expel all the Jews from Rome and stuff like that, including Aquila and Priscilla. So yeah, I would argue that the best explanation is that Claudius made this edict in the early 40s AD. Now there are some controversies, right? So in terms of the translation of the text, Richard Carrier, a Jesus mythicist and radical skeptic, he claims, well, no, this edict is meant for pagans. It's not meant for Jews. And he mistranslates himself. He gives his own interpretation where he's talking about, look, it's not talking about stealing bodies from the tombs, but grave robbers stealing the tombs themselves, which just on the face of it is ridiculous to think, right? Virtually all modern scholars deny Richard Carrier's translation from the mid-20th century onward. And one of the major reasons is that Carrier mistranslates the Greek word treskion, I believe, as cult of the ancestors, which is pagan terminology. But in reality, the word in the text has been proven by all scholars that it clearly means religion or a religious observances, which is strictly and uniquely Jewish phraseology. So, you know, and the same word is found in Josephus. It's also found in the New Testament among Jewish Christians and that sort of thing. Also think about it. Pagans typically didn't have family tombs or sepulchers. That was unique to the Jews. Pagans, they preferred to cremate their dead or throw them in a common pit or something like that. So there's no mention in this edict of digging up funeral urns from the ground and stuff like that. No, this is specifically about tombs, which only the Jews had in the first century. It also speaks of the rolling stone, the Kokim tombs. And again, only Jews had these kinds of sepulchers in the Roman world. Secondly, there is a scientific study in the year 2020 that was peer-reviewed where skeptics came out and kind of said that they studied the marble, the origin of the marble of the edict. And it actually came from a quarry on the Greek island of Kos. So it's not from Israel. It's not Nazareth. Therefore, they claimed it has nothing to do with Israel. But unfortunately for these skeptics, actual historians and experts and archaeologists came out and said, this is just the foolish, stupid claim. You're ignorant, scientists. This is why stick to the science. Don't speak on our expertise on the history, because Kos has been archaeologically proven to be a major exporter of marble at this time. And archaeologically, it had a special relationship with both King Herod, with all the King Herods from King Herod the Great's time onward, up to King Herod Agrippa and his sons during the time of Jesus and beyond. So it has been proven they imported marble to Israel, which again supports the traditional understanding. Kos was a known importer that had a strong special relationship with the Herods. They've even archaeologically proven like gems dedicated to King Herod and stuff like that on the island of Kos in the realm of this quarry and stuff like that. So, that's kind of my take on that front. The second and final archaeological proof is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And as a Protestant, this shocked me because I thought for a long time this is just a Roman Catholic claim. I prefer the Protestant garden tomb anyways, which is what my picture is on StreamYard here for you guys. That's a picture of the garden tomb. But actually, archaeologically speaking, there's scholarly consensus that the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Roman Catholic site, is probably correct as the site for Jesus' empty tomb. And the majority of secular archaeologists today, this shocked me, think the site is likely to be authentic. Here are just a handful of some of these non-biased experts supporting probable authenticity. So from fellow Protestant evangelical Christian scholars. So these guys are Christians, but again, they're not Catholics. They don't want to just agree with Catholic legends. So we have New Testament scholars like Dr. Craig Evans and philosopher Dr. William Lane Craig saying, quote unquote, indeed, the tomb beneath the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem is in all probability the tomb in which Jesus himself was laid by Joseph of Arimathea following the crucifixion. Again, these guys are not Catholics. They don't want to just agree with Catholics. Their bias would say we want to disagree with this, right? So we can't take that statement just lying down. There must be good reason as to why these Protestants are admitting this. In terms of secular archaeology, we have Dr. Shimon Gibson and Dan Bahat, who Dan Bahat was the former city archaeologist of Jerusalem. And so Shimon, he's the former British-born archaeologist and professor of practice, the Department of History at UNC Chapel Hill, University of North Carolina. And Gibson was the lead archaeologist excavating a wilderness cave he associated with John the Baptist in 2000. So these scholars say, quote unquote, "We may not be absolutely certain that the site of the Holy Sepulchre Church is the site of Jesus' burial, but we certainly have no other site that can lay a claim nearly as weighty. And despite multiple opportunities for falsification, we really have no reason to reject the authenticity of the site." Furthermore, German-born archaeologist Dr. Katharina Galore, who specializes in this area, she says, quote unquote, "The original set of walls were later expanded by King Herod Agrippa in 41 to 44 AD and were completed before the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, during which they were completely destroyed. This indicates that the tradition of the Holy Sepulchre likely dates to around the 40s AD, as the site of the original walls was lost later on to make way for the new set of walls. Had the site been a later legendary invention, it would be expected that Jesus' tomb would be outside Jerusalem's expanded wall rather than in its original wall. This is largely considered the best piece of evidence in favor of the site's authenticity." And finally, we have Dr. Joan Taylor, who I really respect her work. She was a former skeptic as a scholar here, as a historian. She said the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, rubbish. That's not the tomb of Jesus. Get out of here. But then she, with Dr. Shimon Gibson, she engaged in some actual archaeological excavation around the site in Israel. And oh my goodness, she changed her mind big time. She says, quote unquote, "In my book, Christians in the Holy Places, I argued that Constantine chose to build his martyrarium basilica in honor of the cross on the site of the former Temple of Venus because of mere convenience, and that the Temple of Venus itself was built here without any plan to cover up a Christian holy place. As I have worked over the material again, I have noted that this understanding of Golgotha as the execution place alone, though a common one, is not supported by the combined evidence of the canonical gospels. Moreover, the tomb is not said to be very near the site of the crucifixion. This has led me to a further reconsideration of all the available evidence and the discovery of additional material in the New Testament Apocrypha, which may bear upon the issues. In this article, I will argue that the crucifixion was indeed further south than the traditional site would locate it, as I argued previously, but that the traditional tomb of Jesus may very well be authentic." So that's coming from a past skeptic. Incredible. So we've got scholarly consensus on our side here. And yes, essentially just a couple things. So Golgotha was not a small isolated spot. We tend to think of the Hill of Calvary or something like that. That didn't exist until the 6th century AD. That's right where the church is now, right? They have that rock of the cross, which was known once the pagan temples were built and stuff. But it's not really a spot. Back in the first century, it was a region. The Bible calls it a topos, or region, a larger area. Golgotha, there is no one site Golgotha. There was a bunch of Golgothas, plural, in the first couple centuries, places of the beheadings or the execution places. Shimon Gibson and Joan Taylor have excavated this entire region and area and proved that it was used as an Iron Age quarry on a slope. There's also been topsoil that has been found in various areas in this region, suggesting that it was in the first century being intensively farmed right outside the Gennith Gate. And that's incredible, because this is not area that's good for farming typically, right? But this area specifically was converted. Oh, sounds like the garden tomb. There was a garden there. They've proven that archaeologically. I'm just going to have Joan Taylor kind of mention one of her main reasons for changing her mind here in a clip that I did. So let me, our 54-minute mark.
The future of your business is here. With Wix, you get advanced AI capabilities.
And remember, even though Hadrian's temperance is appeal to an...
All right, so let me just confirm you guys are seeing that. Yep, okay. Okay, I'm just gonna entire screen. Okay, so I'm just gonna play about a 10-minute clip here from my Jesus Mythicism Refuted Part 3 episode, where I go over the archaeological evidences and I go into a lot more detail than I am here. But let's take a listen to what I said about Joan Taylor's reasoning.
Attesting miracle in this time. Oh, God, an angel appeared and said, this is it. This is the tomb. Oh, now I know it's the right one. Interestingly, we don't get this from Helena or Constantine's peeps or anything. There's no mention of, oh, and a miracle happened and showed me the spot, or, you know, an image of the cross floated and took me exactly to the tomb where our Lord had been slain. So, no, what was it that made it self-evident that this thing was the tomb of our Lord, Jesus Christ? How did they know that? Just obviously. And it's because there had been absolute proof. It had been preserved, and it would had telling features that a natural person could just naturally know and consider to be self-evident. You know, and this is, like I said, Joni Taylor, this was one of her reasons for being a skeptic originally. And when she actually thought about it and looked into the matter and researched in depth, she realized that was rubbish. Absolutely, this is not a problem. And this proves it must be authentic. Because in her words, quote unquote, it seems to me that the fact that the tomb was considered self-evident is one of the most important factors that points to the probable authenticity of the traditional site of Jesus' burial tomb. The traditional view has one key element in its favor, the one that is usually completely ignored. It gives us a perfect reason why no physical proof or legitimating miracle was required for anyone to believe that the tomb was genuine. The reason it was genuine was that it was precisely in the right place, under the statue of Jupiter, as everyone in the Jerusalem church believed. So people only had to remove the statue of Jupiter, find out, yep, there's the perfect tomb of Jesus, just exactly underneath, as everybody said. No further proof was required. It requires us to believe, basically, Hadrian did indeed cover up the tomb purposefully and placed a statue of Jupiter on top of it. And then she goes on and says, quote unquote, previously I have felt that this course of action would not have occurred to Hadrian, who was hardly the most vociferous opponent of Christians. Remember, in our part two show, we read Hadrian. He was quite temperate. He wasn't trying to wipe the Christians out or go after them. He was kind of just like Trajan. He's like, well, if they're a problem, you got to do what you got to do, but don't go seeking them and stuff like that. Don't go out of your way. Well, that's not true here. Actually, Hadrian hated the Jews and Jewish Christians and that sort of thing. After the Bar Kokhba rebellion, he was outraged. That's why we got Palestine instead of Judea. And, you know, the Palestinians versus Jews today and stuff like that, it all started here, this hatred towards Jews in the second century to a massive scale. And this is where Christians started distancing themselves from Jews for all eternity, for the rest of time and that sort of thing, because of the Bar Kokhba rebellion. That peeved off Hadrian like heck. And he hated all Jews and Jewish Christians and that sort of thing. So after that, yeah, that's why he changed his tune and wanted to wipe them out and wipe out their memory and wipe out their religions. And remember, even though Hadrian
this, yeah, I don't know if I don't think they're saying what I wanted there, but okay. So I'm just going to go back and finish off just showing you guys some pictures. So here is what the Garden Tomb site would have looked like according to their archaeological excavations. So you can see the garden around it that they've discovered from the topsoil. And then here's what Joan Taylor's archaeological excavations have uncovered, right? So why this is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, right? This is what has traditionally been understood to be Jesus' crucifixion site and empty tomb in the same place. But what they've discovered archaeologically is that Golgotha, according to the Gospels, is an entire region next to the gate. So she believes Jesus was crucified here by the axe, which makes sense, by two roads right by the gate. Remember, the Romans, by crucifying you, that was a public display that you are a scumbag to people walking on the road. So it doesn't make sense for the crucifixion site to be over here. where Roman Catholics have traditionally said, no, it was much closer to the crossroads by the original gate. Now, the thing here that she was talking about is that very soon, within a couple decades, the Romans completely changed this landscape so that it was no longer the same, right? They extended the gates and stuff like that. They had the new North Road going out and stuff like that. And then here's Z. This is where the empty tomb that they've discovered. And it is a tomb precisely described as the Gospels describe it, right? With the ledge and the rolling stone and stuff like that. So it perfectly fits. And it's in the same vicinity as the Church of the Holy Sepulchre kind of thing. So this is what Joan Taylor is saying, right? It's a region, and this is how they kind of relate to each other. Later on, this is where once the Temple of Venus, once the Jews revolted under the Bar Kokhba Rebellion in about 132 to 135 AD, the Emperor Hadrian got personally peeved. And he wiped out any sites of the Jewishness garden and all this stuff. And he rebuilt the road, the Cardo Maximus, which is, I saw it when I was in Israel with my own eyes. It's still there to this day. And then he rebuilt the roads outside of the gate. So Jesus' crucifixion site was lost underneath this road, according to Joan Taylor. And the Temple of Venus was built around the empty tomb site, which incorporated the traditional site as well as the real Zed site that Joan Taylor is suggesting is Jesus's actual empty tomb in the vicinity of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which was subsequently, you know, taken over as the pagan Temple of Venus once Hadrian, you know, hated the Jews and built this to punish the Jews. And he put a statue of Jupiter right on the spot that Christians would have known was Jesus's empty tomb spot. That preserved the location of it until the time of Constantine, when he comes and he finally, through his mom, builds the Church of the Holy Sepulchre on the spot, on the Y spot that we have today. So that's her theory as to how it works. And yeah, under my show, Jesus Mythicism Refuted, Part 3, I go over all of the specific details as to why this theory is true and works. I also, on my blog for that Jesus Mythicism Refuted Part 3 episode, I provide Joan Taylor's scholarly peer-reviewed paper for free for you guys to read and see the details for yourselves. So I think that's it in terms of the, oh goodness. Okay, so I am getting an email. David Kemble Cook misunderstood about the time. Okay, there was a change in the 1 hour. Okay, so yeah, so he apologizes. He kind of messed up with there was a change in time zones and stuff. So maybe that's why he wasn't there. But anyways, David Casey, I hope that this was helpful to you. I know it's a boring solo show, but I try my best to answer all your questions from your slides. So the math is done. I'm not going to do any more shows because I've done so many, and it's not just you, but other skeptics. They keep wanting me to repeat the same stuff about Bayes' theorem and Jeffrey conditionalization formulas over and over again. And I've reached my limit. This was going to be the last one. I'm sorry you weren't here for it, but nonetheless, I took your questions. You watched my shows and I provided my answer and you've got, I'll send the slides to you and stuff like that. So I think it's done. I'm not going to do another show on the maths again. Let's move on and start getting into the historical evidence for the resurrection. I presented these two archaeological proofs on a balance of probabilities that the empty tomb is true. Let's take it from there. Next time we cut together, I'll let you give your take. Like for the first 20 minutes, you can give your uninterrupted take of what you thought of this show, since you weren't here to dialogue. And then let's move on into other evidences. Like I said, Gary Habermas lists at least 21 separate independent lines of historical evidence proving there was an empty tomb. So I want to start getting into some of those based on the historical sources themselves, rather than on separate archaeological proofs, which is what I covered here. that's it. I hope you guys enjoyed. Have a great week, everyone. Any questions, Vulture, if you're still there, any questions about the archaeological stuff that I was talking about, or because I know that's interesting. I'll give you a couple minutes if, or whoever the one person is. Okay. I guess not. Cool. Never mind. Well, have a great week, everyone. And next. Oh, Brian. Hey. Okay. So it's Brian. Nice job. Thank you, Brian. I know it was a little bit awkward. I wasn't expecting a solo show today, so I had to kind of give that presentation on the spot. But Brian, you'll be very interested to know that next week I am going to be doing a show on someone, a skeptic who I've never been on a show before, Kevin Non-Tradicath, who's a non-traditional Catholic and has become a skeptic. He's an unbeliever, but he is very interested on my take on the Shroud of Turin. So I'm going to be going on his show to speak about the Shroud of Turin. And he's got objections. He's posted a short 14-minute video as to why he doesn't believe in the Shroud. So I'm going to give a response and dialogue with him on that. Also, Robert Schneider, the famous Hollywood actor from Adam Sandler movies, Waterboy, Beverly Hillbillies, which is one of my favorite movies with him in it. The comedian Rob Schneider is converted to Christianity in part why? The Shroud of Turin. Check out on the Graceful Guest, I think is what it's called. Just type in Rob Schneider and the Shroud of Turin. He's doing an interview with Joe Marino, who converted him in part to the Shroud of Turin. And he's actually making a new Hollywood movie on the Shroud of Turin, like Hollywood level movie, not a cheap Christian movie or something on a low budget. He multi-million dollar budget, a professional Hollywood movie that he says will be on the same scale as Passion of the Christ. So check out that. I'll put a link on my blog. That's great news for people who are pro Shroud. And what was the other thing? And then the following week, Kevin's going to be coming on my show to talk about something I'm really excited about, evaluating the Eucharistic Catholic miracles and miracle sites. So I've never done shows giving a evaluation of Eucharistic miracles and stuff. I've had Caleb Jackson on, who kind of mentions healings and stuff like that, but I've never really assessed the Eucharistic miracles. Well, I'm going to be bringing on Kevin, who has evaluated these and is skeptical of them, to kind of go over them. So look forward to that and have a great week, everybody. All right. Take care. And my apologies again, you didn't have a dialogue like we're expecting. So I hope it was entertaining and informative. All right. Take care.